From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And our first guest this morning is going to be Lauren Barrow, a lawyer and co-leader of Citizens Climate Lobby, who will be talking about an upcoming event. And then, Chris, we're going to do a rebroadcast from author Tony Hiss, who wrote the book Rescuing the Planet, Protecting Half the Land to Heal the Earth.
That's right. Then, in the second part of the show, we'll talk to another author, CBS News national correspondent Jonathan Vigliotti. Will come on to discuss his newly released book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Discussion of the climate crisis has always suffered from a problem of abstraction. Data points and warnings of an overheated future struggle to break through the noise of everyday life. But climate change and its devastating consequences has kept the pace, whether we want to pay attention or not.
CBS News national correspondent Jonathan Vigliotti has seen that crisis unfold for himself, spending nearly two decades reporting across the United States, documenting the people, communities, landmarks, and traditions we've already surrendered. Vigliotti shares with urgency and personal touch the story of an America on the brink. That's in the second part of the show.
Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the first part of the show is Lauren Barrows. She's an attorney and also a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. And Lauren, you're here to talk about a film or a couple of films that are going to be shown tomorrow night at the Santee Auditorium. Thanks for coming on and talk to us a little bit about these films.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Yeah, share with us what this event is all about and what people can look forward to seeing at the Jim Santee tomorrow.
Well, the event starts at 5:30. That's when doors open. And at 6, we're going to show two short films. The first one is Downstream, and the second one is Going Greenland. Downstream is made by some local professional skiers, and it connects the great powder we have with climate change and with the Great Salt Lake. And it does, I think, a really good job of kind of making that connection so people can understand that. And it's also just, there's great footage of skiing in it. And then the next movie, Going Greenland, is made by Rachel Burks. She's a professional skier who also lives here in Utah, and she did a big ski trip to Greenland and then talks about climate change in the movie as well. Then after those movies, and those movies will take up about a half hour or so, we're going to have Rachel Burks from Going Greenland, Megan Dingman, Thorin Merrill, Zach Curry, who made Downstream. They're going to be on a panel, and our local DCL volunteer, Montana Barak, she's a senior at Park City High School, she's going to moderate the panel. And then Haley Keller is a graduate student at the University of Utah. She's gone to Washington, D.C. with our group twice now to lobby, and she's going to be on the panel as well. And so this is it's free, but we're asking for donations to help raise a little bit of money for scholarships to send more students back to D.C. in June to lobby with us on climate change issues.
So this is great for kids and their parents to go to together.
For sure. It's a really good event. I think that everyone's going to like it. It's it combines a lot of fun things, you know, getting to watch a lot of great ski footage, learning about Greenland, learning about the Great Salt Lake, and then really having a good discussion about what motivated them to make these movies, what are some of the challenges they see, how they see themselves in the future of political activism. And I feel like a lot of kids can learn from it and kind of have some good mentors to look up to.
Right. And again, these two films they're short films, because if I heard you right, it's only a half hour each or a half hour total?
Total. So Downstream, I think, is about 10, 12 minutes, and Going Greenland's about 20-some minutes.
Okay. So don't do the Park City thing and arrive 10 minutes late to these
films. That's right. You don't want to miss them.
Right. Right, or else you miss it, and you'll just be... But the Q&A will be just as interesting. Talk, in the last couple minutes, talk a little bit about the lobbying impacts, particularly when you have the younger generation joining you to go to D.C. and lobby. What does a typical lobbying session look like?
Well, the lobbying session, really have to back up. It's a national conference on Lobby Day. And so we arrive on a Saturday. The conference runs Saturday night, Sunday, Monday, and then Tuesday we lobby. And that we've done this for years. And during those days leading up to the Lobby Day, you're paired with your lobby group or groups. And often you're matched with a couple different congressional representatives or staffers from their office. So you might show up and you'll find out that you're going to be lobbying Representative John Curtis. Mm. You're going to be lobbying Senator Mike Lee, and you're going to be lobbying someone from Arizona, you know, maybe a Democrat from that state. And then you connect with those people during the 2-3 days of conference. And that conference is a normal, typical conference with panels about climate change and all mm-hmm. sorts of related issues. But you connect with those groups and you plan, you know, how are we going to do this? One person's going to get all the minutes from previous lobby meetings. They're going to kind of bring everyone up to speed. Another person is going to research, you know, here are the bills, here's the pieces of legislation we want to ask them to support. And then they say, okay, Julie, you focus on this piece of legislation. And they'll, you know, it's so terrific. They really help kids understand just summaries of legislation. So they don't have to do anything to prepare ahead of time, but
right.
they don't even have to do a ton of research there. But it's really exciting and pretty bonding. And the best part is just seeing how nervous everyone gets, you know, how the kids get beforehand, and then going through it together. And then afterwards, everyone's so elated. And usually, especially when we bring kids, the reception is really warm and positive. And it's just wonderful to celebrate together and over time to see how it makes a difference. So whenever we get there now, they generally say, oh, we love seeing you guys. We really like your approach. We feel like you don't attack us, but you just educate us, and we go to you for questions. And it's reinforcing.
Well, we got to run, but let's have you on and maybe the kids too, or other representatives another time in the future to talk more about that process, because it's a really fascinating system. And process as you describe it. But most importantly, tomorrow night, the Santee Auditorium, doors open at 5:30. Two short films, Going Greenland and Downstream, hosted by the Citizens Climate Lobby. A Q&A after that to talk about each of the films and the Citizens Climate Lobby in general. Lauren, thank you.
Lauren Barros,
thank you so much for joining us on this quick version of This
you
Green
bet.
Earth. We'll see you tomorrow
Thanks.
Night.
It's a treat to be here. All right. Take care.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Lauren. Bye. And now we're going to go into rebroadcast that we like so much. We're going to play it twice. Tony Hiss, Rescuing the Planet, Protecting Half the Land to Heal the Earth.
I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the show is Tony Hiss. Among other things, he's the author of the new book, Rescuing the Planet, Protecting Half the Land to Heal the Earth. Tony, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be with both of you. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's start with you. Give us a little background about yourself and how you got ultimately into the world of writing about environment and ecology, et cetera.
Well, I'm an East Coast guy. And when I got out of college, I went to work at the New Yorker magazine. Was a writer there for about 30 years.
Hmm.
And then after that, I've been a visiting scholar at New York University for about 25 years. This is my 15th book.
Hmm.
And it came about after some conversations with the great Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson,
right,
who died recently and who was considered the father of biodiversity, the great champion of all life. And we were talking, and he said that we needed to think at a larger scale in order to be able to do anything useful. Now that something like 2 million species are in danger of becoming extinct.
Hmm.
So he said, we've got to protect more land. How do we get people's attention? And I came up with the phrase half earth, because the science seems to say that if we could protect half of most critters' habitats, then they could flourish. And Ed liked the idea. And he said, this is what used to be called among business types a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal.
Right.
You have to set a goal that isn't too big, because then people are discouraged from even trying, and isn't too small, because then you could just accomplish it and be done with it. I guess the most notable example is the space program back in the 60s,
right.
Put a man on the moon in a decade. Well, the biodiversity crisis has always been, is one part of the environmental crisis, and the first part of being the poisoning of the place that Rachel Carson alerted us to way back when.
Right.
Second part being the climate crisis, which is hitting us over the head now in a way that can't avoid thinking about. This part's been harder to think about, and it's been overshadowed. But a year ago, 193 countries met in Montreal and decided to take as an official global goal, setting aside at least 30% of the planet in this decade, 30 by 30, as a step towards 50% by 2050, 50 by 50. So I'm trying to introduce people to the whole subject, and also to tell them that there are a lot of good things already happening, people sort of taking up the cause. And I got to go all over the US and North American continent and finding people who are doing wonderful work, many of whom never heard of each other.
Right. So when you say setting aside, what do we mean by setting aside? What does
question.
That look like? And give and perhaps some examples of that.
Well, traditionally we've talked, you know, we started with the land protection movement over 100 years ago with national parks, and also supplemented by what local land trusts can do in either buying or putting easements on land.
Mm-hmm.
But our focus is now changing in a way that I find very interesting. The more we look around, the more we realize that everywhere we look is saturated with life. There's life beneath our feet. There's life over our head. There's life down into the bottom of the depths of the ocean. And of course, we naturally tend to think as being subject to the force of gravity, that we live on Earth. But in fact, we live within this strange envelope of life called the biosphere, which goes down below us and extends up above us. And although life seems to have emerged on Earth very relatively early on, and has produced extraordinary continuity of life ever since then, most species live within a range from the top of Mount Everest down to the bottom of a trench below the Pacific Ocean. And that's only vertically a distance of about 12 and a half miles, which, as someone pointed out, if you've stretched out vertically, horizontally, you could drive across in maybe 20 minutes.
Right.
So in addition to the ancientness and the vast abundance of the place, there is this thinness built in, this vulnerability, which we're only beginning to wake up to.
So
in protecting land, sometimes it means owning it, but sometimes it just means taking responsibility for it. What we're now learning is really, there's no such thing as a vacant piece of land,
right,
or an empty lot, because it's full of life. It may not have our purposes added, but it's got life already. So the challenge now is, if we're going to add our uses to it, can we do it in a way that doesn't just obliterate what's already there? And I think we have to come up with, I've started calling, all species design, meaning how do we fit in a way that doesn't just elbow everything else aside?
So say, for example, out west here, we can have kind of the obvious parcels of land that have been quote unquote set aside, maybe national parks or national wildlife reserves, or it can be considered examples of setting aside. But might it also include, say, ranchers who are also trying to act, you know, in a sustainable manner and trying to
absolutely
work the land while also kind of doing their best to conserve and preserve the land too?
Oh, I think they're an essential part of the
right
solution. And more and more ranchers, well, ranchers grew up devoted to the land. So they are naturally guardians of the land, and they're very much part of any solution. And good things are happening in Utah. Well, for one thing, you've got one of the most remarkable beings anywhere, the Aspen Grove Pando,
yeah,
in the center of the state,
right,
which is considered the largest living creature. A single tree that is 3.2 million pounds in weight, covering 106 acres. It looks like a forest, but it's actually a single tree with 40,000 branches coming up from the extraordinary root system. And also just last year, your legislature set aside $20 million to build wildlife crossing structures across and under highways, because
right,
we've just been learning, as we learn more and more about the patterns of animals, how predators and prey behave, that the highways we've built have often been a kind of fencing, wasn't intended to be, separating animal populations, and now we can reconnect those populations across the highway, and in addition, prevent extraordinary number of crashes, which not only take human lives but cost huge amounts in terms of collision damage, to repair. And you're also home to one of the groups that I've found to be the most effective groups, the Wildlands Network, headquartered in Salt Lake City, a medium-sized group, but it thinks at a continental scale. It's working in Mexico, as well as here in the States and up in Canada. So it's right, an exciting time, as well as a time that needs to be very carefully thought about.
Right.
And you referred to ranchers as guardians of the land, and you also talk about indigenous people and their place in all of this. And there are indigenous protected areas now that they are driving. And where is this being successfully modeled, and how can we learn from that?
Well, the what's still the most intact and largest landscape anywhere seems to be the boreal forest up in Canada. Down here in the States, even in open country like Utah, we have been told that the frontier disappeared, you know, a century ago. But if instead of looking from east to west, we look from north to south, right at the top of the continent is this extraordinary, enormous landscape, the boreal forest, where the indigenous people, although they were not well treated by Canadian governments for far, far too long, were never displaced. But now the Canadian government is turning to them and thinking that the only way Canada could ever meet a 30 by 30 goal is by setting up these enormous parks that would be stewarded by the indigenous people who are already there. Indigenous protected areas, as you said, Claire. And some of them are going to dwarf the size of regular national parks. If we think of Yellowstone, which is 2 million acres, as a sort of common denominator of size of national parks, some of these will be 3, 4, 5 times the size of Yellowstone. So that's a very exciting development.
We're speaking with Tony Hiss. He's the author of the new book, Rescuing the Planet, Protecting Half the Land to Heal the Earth. And Tony, we've been focusing on the land, but are we also including the oceans here as part of the 50%?
Oh, sorry.
Like marine sanctuaries? Well, we're in Utah, so you can understand.
I know.
We overlooked that. But important to say, protect that too.
Immensely important.
Yeah.
And essentially important, because so much of life and so much of where we are in terms of life is out there in the oceans. And it's, as has often been said recently, we know less about the ocean and its contents than we do about the moon or Mars.
Right.
It's been opaque to us because, of course, we can't just hop in and see it. Now we have a new generation of submersible craft, either crewed or remote, and we're just beginning to see some of the extraordinary things down there. Knocking our socks off, whole ranges of life, some of which don't even need oxygen to live, but can live off the sulfur coming out of the vents at the bottom of the ocean. So yes, it's hugely important. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, well, if we're trying to get to 50% by 2050, and I think you said that we're also trying to first get to 30% by 2030, what percentage would you say we are at right now? How are we doing?
Well, it is a BHAG, all right. I mean, I think we're at about 15%, and it's taken us a century and a half since Yellowstone to get there. And now we're talking about doubling that in less than 10 years. That's certainly a stretch. The Biden administration, whatever you think about them, did sort of adopt that as a national goal. And several states have set this 30 by 30 up as a statewide goal. California for one, and New York State, my state, for another. And I've found that there are people responding in ways that they wouldn't have expected. There's a land trust up in Western New York, which is, New York's a big state, not by your standards, but it's a big state.
Right.
And just east of Lake Erie, way at the west end of New York State, south of Buffalo, it turns out there's this extraordinary forest that's full of biodiversity and a gorgeous place. And it has somehow survived all these years, probably because the Iroquois Indians, Native Americans, kept it alive. Well, a land trust up there, a plucky land trust that had protected over 30 years, maybe 8,000, 12,000 acres, suddenly has discovered this forest, and its new project is going to protect this forest. Well, this forest is 1.1 million acres.
Hmm.
So suddenly they're leaping ahead in terms of what they think they can do and what they think needs to be done. And I was also invited just a couple of months ago to the first ever meeting of something called the Mega Eco Projects Group. Well, this is people from all over the world who are working at the largest possible scale of protection. People from Africa, people from China, people from Korea, millions and millions of acres, and covering very multiple countries at once. And they got so excited at being in the same room together for the first time that they now are going to form an ongoing group called the Mega Eco Projects Alliance. So, it's an awful lot that's just popping up. It almost feels like, you know, we're being called to do it because of the urgency of the situation.
Right.
I like how you said that there is no real vacant land, because we do say that a lot. There's a vacant plot. There's a vacant land. And we just were talking with someone about jumping spiders and how every species matters to our ecosystem. And you do describe this as a hopeful book, Rescuing the Planet. Can you give us specific examples of people working to keep plants and animals alive?
Well, one of the people I found most interesting to be in touch with was a guy from Northwest Florida called M.C. Davis, who had grown up a hard scrabble kind of guy. He actually made his first dollars playing poker, but then became a hugely successful commodities broker, never thought much about the land or about animals or plants, until one day he was caught in a traffic jam in Florida, sat there fuming, didn't know what to do, glanced around and saw a billboard outside a high school that said Black Bear Seminar. And he thought, anything's better than this. So he peeled off, went inside the school auditorium. He said, sparsely attended meeting, couple of Canadians who were lost looking maybe for day-old donuts. And up on the stage, two women who were talking about the plight of Florida black bears, which is a local subvariant species of eastern black bears. And suddenly he got hooked. He thought, I never thought about these people, these animals trying to survive just as we're trying to survive. And the next day, he sent the two ladies enough money for them to keep going for a couple of years, which made them suspicious. Who is this stranger coming in? What do you want? And he said, well, what I want is a list of all the 100 best environmental books, because I'm way behind and I want to educate myself. So he read the books and decided that if you were going to help save the bears, you had to save their habitat, which was this longleaf pine forest, which had been the signature ecosystem of the whole Southeast, but had disappeared after the Civil War because that was the one way left to the landowners to make some money, to chop down this extraordinary forest. It's the reason why Scarlett O'Hara never went hungry again. So he bought up some played out peanut farms for a song, wound up with about 51,000 acres of land that was considered junk.
Right.
And started replanting longleaf pine forest. I ran across him about 13 years later. Place still looked awful scruffy to me, but he said, well, come back in another 287 years. This is a 300-year project. We're just getting started. But black bears had already ambled in. He was also saving this extraordinary animal called the gopher tortoise,
right,
which burrows beneath the soil down there. And is itself, its burrow is used by hundreds of other species as a place of refuge, because in the gopher tortoise burrows, temperature stays the same pretty much all year round, about 70 degrees, doesn't freeze in winter, doesn't bake in summer. So here was this guy just deciding something could be done and I can do it, and he did it. Well, he's passed on now, but he endowed the place with enough money to keep going. And there you have it. And it will not only be something extraordinary in itself, but it will connect up to an Air Force base to the west, which has some longleaf pine forest and other longleaf pine forest to the east. So this just sort of emerged out of nowhere, right, but there it is.
If you liken your book to this black bear conversation that these two women had, what do you hope that people take away, or is there actions that you want people to take after reading your book?
Well, the thing is, there's actions almost any one of us can take, and at any level. Of course, there are good places to send money to, but you can also just get involved. Here in the East, there's an extraordinary movement called the Homegrown National Park. Turns out that U.S. lawns, the amount of grass seed we raise, is probably almost equal to the amount of wheat we grow and the amount of corn we grow. But it's a sterile kind of growth, because those grass plots are not friendly to other species. However, if you take just a tiny bit of it and replant with some native plants, then the bees can come back and the other pollinating insects. And so that's having great success. It's something we can all jump into with both feet, no matter where we are, in town, in a city, in a suburb, out in the countryside.
Right.
So many efforts underway. And the book tries to introduce the whole subject, both in terms of its urgency, but also in terms of the amazing amount of good work that's already underway and that we can all embrace and become part of.
Right. To a butterfly or a bee or most insects, lawns are front and back yards, our lawns are just flyover country, right?
So, exactly. But if you give them stopping places within the flyover country, then they can bounce from one to the next.
Exactly. Well, we got to wrap up. Tony Hiss, the author of Rescuing the Planet, Protecting Half the Land to Heal the Earth. You have a website, Tony?
I should.
All right.
I urge you to take a look at the book if you have a chance. And I'd love to hear from anyone.
All right. Well, you'll certainly hear.
TonyHiss@nyu.edu.
TonyHiss@nyu.edu. Tony, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Oh, thank you, Chris and Claire.
And you are listening to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And our next guest is CBS National News correspondent Jonathan Vigliotti, who has just released a new book called Before It's Gone. stories from the front lines of climate change in small town America. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are excited to have you and get into this book. But first, I want you to share a little bit about your background and how you got started in journalism and specifically covering climate.
I have always loved nature and wildlife. My journey for me began as a kid growing up in the 90s on the East Coast in a town called Mount Kisco in New York State. And back then, if you were to visit the blue house with the red door on Meadowbrook Lane and ask my parents where I was, they would most likely tell you I was in the nearby woods playing. I was a Boy Scout. I loved retreating to those woods. I would write, draw. I did everything as a kid growing up there. And it was around the same time I learned how fragile our ecosystem is because a housing development was proposed in those very woods. And that was also the time that I learned the power of the word, in this case, written words, because my parents, along with everyone in the community, came together to write leaders in protest of this development. They were specifically concerned about the nearby wetlands and the impact the development would have on nesting birds. And ultimately, I would like to think those letters mattered, that this community activated as one mattered, because that development was scrapped. And today, when I go back to the same home on Meadowbrook Lane, I also return to those woods, which are still there today. And I continue to daydream whenever I go there. And that really launched me on this mission, first through photography, and then through radio and reporting, and eventually television news, and using video as another element to tell stories initially of our environmental crossroads, similar to what happened in my backyard. I went to Fordham University in the Bronx, and then from there, launched to my first job in Grand Junction, Colorado, and pinballed across the country as a rookie reporter to Milwaukee, Miami, then New York before joining CBS News as a foreign correspondent initially in 2015. I was based out of the London Bureau and then made my way because of my coverage of a wildfire when I was assisting when there was a staff shortage to the West Coast Bureau. I moved here in 2019, where I really started to ramp up specifically my coverage of extreme weather events and climate change, responsible for fueling them all.
And you've written a lot about natural disasters, a lot about the aftermath of what happens. And now in this book, you're concentrating on mostly small towns. And I'd like for you to talk about that, but also in the book, instead of just the aftermath, you're covering the possible maybe predictions or in some cases, lack of preparation that could also work into these disasters.
That's correct. And it oftentimes comes from people not imagining or understanding climate change and its impact on our weather. I've always believed that journalism, specifically storytelling, is a powerful tool to help people understand how our world works. And I've been given unique access as a journalist who has, for the past 5 years or so, specifically for CBS, traveled across the country covering every kind of weather disaster, oftentimes they're called historic disasters, and I've covered countless historic disasters. It was my hope through this book that I could bring viewers and readers along to these front lines so that they as well could visualize through my words the impacts and understand the impact climate change is having on all of this, not just radicalizing our weather, but then that radicalized weather and its impact on our small towns. I focus specifically on small towns first and foremost, because that's where I oftentimes found myself reporting on these stories. But all of these small towns are connected because they lack infrastructure, engineering, and the kinds of budgets that bigger cities have. So when a big storm does hit one of these communities, they're easily erased from the map. Over the past 5 years or so, I've covered more than a handful of communities that have been destroyed by fire, by hurricane, by tornado. And all of these small towns, I believe, are like canaries in the coal mine for bigger cities, because Mother Nature is beginning to outpace our ability and all of man's modern tools to hold her back. And more what we're seeing in these smaller communities, which is easy to forget as the media attention moves on, is going to start to impact bigger cities. I've seen this and reported on this firsthand with Superstorm Sandy in 2012 in New York City. And there's going to be more storms like this. And we've seen this countless times in bigger cities, but they oftentimes rebound quickly. What happens, though, when we start to lose our grip, which we are beginning to lose our grip? Going back to New York City briefly, just in 2021, there was a spike in sinkholes, 31%, a 31% spike. And the community came together and local organizers, and they said, you can throw as much money as you want at this issue. We're running out of engineering solutions to prevent more sinkholes from happening. So what happens when that begins, kind of this new reality we have? And what can we do now to protect ourselves, to develop new engineering solutions to build more resilient communities? It's one of the main questions in the book. And I hope the takeaway is we are all individually and as individual communities empowered to take action.
Well, the book is broken into four parts. There's fire, there's water, air, and earth. You kind of touched on briefly fire, you know, with, let's, you know, the classic iconic examples being, say, Paradise, California, Lahaina now, and
yeah,
just
with,
yeah, this past year of communities just, well, you know, wiped out effectively. And now trying to, in Lahaina's case, they're still, you know, trying to assess the extent of damage.
Yeah.
They haven't even begun to rebuild. They're just trying to, at this point, clean up from the videos I periodically see. But those are those are classic examples of system, weather systems, and perhaps climate influencing, in this case, wildfire systems. Are you seeing, have you had other examples that you wrote about or covered?
Yes, and in each element, there are examples of this. And I'll touch on Lahaina in a second, but most notably in the air section, I focus on the impact of tornadoes on more eastern states. You know, traditional Tornado Alley was traditionally west of Mississippi, but research has shown that our warming atmosphere is pushing the traditional Tornado Alley further east into areas that researchers call Tornado Fatality Alley because of the higher number of people living in these communities. And so what you're seeing are more severe storms, supercell systems, which birth not just one, but many tornadoes. And in 2021, the winter of 2021, we saw the impact of one such system, which meteorologists called the Beast, a mile wide tornado that traveled on the ground for more than 100 miles and destroyed Dawson Springs and Mayfield in Kentucky. And these were communities that were not prepared and did not truly understand the threat. They have had tornadoes in the past, nothing quite like this. And little did anyone really know at the time the impact that the weather was having on making these events perhaps more likely. One of the main sentences that I wrote in my journal before I began this book, which became kind of the theme of my book before it's gone, is before every disaster, there is usually a scientist that has been ignored. And time and time again, while covering these stories, I have seen that happen. Lahaina is unfortunately a perfect example. My team and I were one of the first network crews to arrive in what was left of downtown Lahaina. 80% of the area was destroyed. More than 100 people were killed. No one received evacuation orders. We arrived to what looked like, and as I described in my book, an environmental holocaust. And what we learned later in the days and weeks that followed, as local leaders described this as an explosion, it was like a bomb going off, implying that there was no time to take action. Scientists actually, nearly a decade before this fire, came out with a report on the island saying that the island was vulnerable to fire because of climate change. And they even offered solutions for what the community could do to prevent this risk, including restoring wetlands, conserving water, which had been depleted because of the growing population and the tourism industry, removing dry and invasive grasses, which had taken root because of where people had grown. And also building and updating homes with fire-resistant materials, which qualified for tax credits and would have lowered insurance bills. But this plan was essentially filed away and nothing was done in time. And so those warnings, unheeded, became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is a common theme in towns across the country. And one of the questions I asked when I was there on the ground reporting, as I walked along historic Front Street, miles of it destroyed, there was one home still standing, unscathed, right. The house with the red roof, as locals there now know it. And this was a home whose residents had updated the building and implemented those scientific remedies before this fire. They removed grasses and bushes and trees that were too close to the home. They put river stones around the foundation of the home to prevent a fire from reaching the foundation of that property as it did that day. And they also put a red metal roof on top of the house. And across the country, in storms by other names, many of those storms covered in my book, there are examples of homes with the red roof. And they all, the homeowners of these homes, share one thing in common. They listened, they were sensitive to the information, even when local leaders necessarily weren't, and they were empowered to take action. And my hope is that more people realize, as individuals, we have the power to take action, to identify risks in our own community, to listen to the experts in our community who are helping identify those risks. And then when understanding them, we can take action. We don't need to be paralyzed by the science that tells us we're threatened. There are oftentimes solutions, right. But those solutions only matter if we listen, understand, and then act on it.
Well, and having lived for years in Florida, I see examples of that too with respect to homes that have been hardened years and years and years ago, who kind of took heed back then of the growing intensity and frequency of hurricanes and tropical systems, and now are there's the ones that are making it through the storm, or at least not beat up as bad as those that don't take heed. So examples of that, you know, like you say, with respect to fire, with respect to hurricanes, and perhaps with respect to tornadoes and hardening homes, yeah, and building more storm shelters. Let me reintroduce you real quick. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jonathan Vigliotti. He's a CBS News national correspondent and author of the new book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Now, Jonathan, you talk about, you know, fire that can wipe out a community, but that community can come back in one form or another. Mm-hmm. Tornadoes that have wiped out communities and those communities return, rebuild, per se. But there are other examples where perhaps rebuilding is not an option. And I always think about the coastal communities where sea level rise and water table rise is slowly eating away at the both from, you know, lessening the land mass and also kind of sinking the land mass at the same time. And I always think about the Florida Keys or the Outer Banks of North Carolina, perhaps certain areas of the New England coast. Do you have some examples of those situations like that?
Yeah, you mentioned the Florida Keys. A study was done by Monroe County, where the Florida Keys exist, yeah, and they looked at specifically a 3-mile stretch of roadway impacting access to one of the communities on the Keys, and they wanted to see how much money it would cost to elevate just 3 miles of road, 1 foot, and they found it would cost $75 million and only guarantee dry roadway through 2030. Hmm. And that was not a financially feasible option for this community. Right now, the discussion is, do we have ferries? Do we offer boat transportation to these homes for when this road does get flooded out and the water doesn't recede? In Fair Bluff, North Carolina, you had this community of about 1,000 people that was first hit in 2016 by Hurricane Matthew, followed by Florence 2 years later. And it wiped out 39 of 40 businesses that were in town. There's only one business that's currently active. Half of the population left. Hmm. The town is now struggling with how to rebuild. They've lost so much of their tax base. They're looking to rebuild downtown to a place called Uptown on a higher elevation, but they only have about 50% of their population. They're struggling with taxes to make this all possible, and they're trying to get money from the federal government to help them rebuild. But more and more, in places that are not sustainable to live, that are too dangerous, we're seeing the federal government come in and do what is considered and called, and it's quite controversial, managed retreat. Hmm. It's a buyout program where they're assisting people who do want to move. And this is not an option that people in wildfire country have. It's being researched to see if it's feasible FEMA is doing this research. But as of now, there's about $700 million that FEMA has to buy back homes from homeowners that are in areas that are simply unsafe to rebuild. But I do think that there is a growing focus on finding safe ways to rebuild communities that can be proven to be resilient in the face of a storm. And we do know that rebuilding back when it is feasible, when it is an option, is sometimes a great option. I mean, you just have to look here in California. Most of the state is impacted by earthquakes, but you don't see people moving away necessarily. You see building codes that have changed. The 1994 Northridge earthquake changed the way we understood how to build. Right. And that's similar to what we're seeing with storms and disasters, environmental disasters. We're seeing communities that are reimagining their building codes to help people find sustainable, safe ways to rebuild in their communities and to make those communities more resilient. And more, that does need to be an option, because the reality is we are running out of space to move into, especially with a growing population, with a lack of affordable housing. We need to reimagine the ways that we have impacted our habitats, and we need to restore our habitats to make them more resilient, much like the scientists on Lahaina had encouraged. And unfortunately, action wasn't taken until it was too late for communities that have not been impacted yet. And a growing number of communities are threatened by climate change. A new study out last month showed nearly half of all American homes are threatened by climate change. This is the time to identify threats and to build resilient communities. So you're not faced with the decision, do I stay or do I go?
Right.
Yeah. And speaking of looking to nature, now, of course, here in Utah, we do deal with wildfire risk, mm-hmm. and we have been working on wildfire mitigation. But you actually were out here in our own backyard in Colville. Can you tell
That's
us
correct.
About that and how you were looking to nature and beavers in particular to help with this?
Beavers are a wonderful species. They are called a keystone species, right. because they have this ability to build wetlands that support an incredible number of species, and also us. They support us and protect us. And this was discovered not by me, but by a researcher in California who, after a wildfire, identified an area of lush vegetation, a huge strip. We're talking about 20 acres that did not go up in flames. Everything around it had burned to the ground, except for this small ecosystem. And what she found at the center of it all was a beaver dam. So beavers, they act as speed bumps when they build their dams. The water still filters through, but it slows it down so that the aquifer and the ground can absorb that water and give birth to lush vegetation that can withstand wildfire. After this discovery, there was this explosion in appreciation for beavers, mm-hmm. because for so long, beavers were first treated as a commodity. They were hunted to near extinction in the right. early 1900s for their fur. And then they were treated as a nuisance because they caused a lot of flooding. But as drought has become pervasive in the West, suddenly landowners realized the benefit of having beavers on their land, and really at zero cost. And so after this research and with this newfound appreciation and fear of fire, we started to see as a nation a new appreciation for the beaver. And in Colville specifically, we went to one rancher's land, a rancher who had eradicated beavers decades earlier from the land, who wanted them back. And I joined one organization based out of Salt Lake City that played a role in reintroducing beavers. And the reason humans have to help out is because streams have become so thin with water that they make beavers very vulnerable to predators. So we went in with this group building beaver analog dams, which is just a fancy word for saying handmade, human-made beaver dams, so that we could reintroduce these beavers into that ecosystem. And sure enough, from last I understand, two beavers were introduced. We saw them as they made their new home there, and they're still thriving. And that area, as a result, has lush vegetation. And more landowners are recognizing the benefits of beavers as natural eco-engineers. And even in the state of California now, there's a new state program to introduce beavers to local communities to help make them more resilient in a very natural way. We're putting beavers to work. They're working at no cost, and they're helping protect us.
Absolutely. They just need to be rebranded. because
they do.
Like you say, they've spent decades and decades or centuries as varmints, right? And pests and nuisances. And now we recognize them as great benefits to the ecosystems and to ourselves. We only have a couple more minutes. And of course, I'm going to ask you a question that will take 5 minutes to answer. But anyway, we interviewed Abram Lustgarten about his book, On the Move, last week or so. Mm-hmm. And then we talk about communities on the move having to say we can't come back for one reason or another. But he also talked about what's interesting, that economies and businesses have to migrate too. And, you know, there will be a point where you won't be able to grow cotton, let's say, in Arizona because it'll be too hot. So whole systems of business and economies may have to move to and migrate. Do you have a quick example of that?
Yeah, yes, and I do believe, and the researchers that I've spoken with stress that it is important, regardless of what community you live in, if there is an opportunity to rebuild back or to strengthen and make a community more resilient, that is the best option. Because being on the move is difficult for both those who are moving and for host communities that are receiving. Right. Oftentimes, and I'm not sure if this was part of your earlier discussion, there is a friction and a tension that comes when you have new people moving into new places, not always being welcomed by those host communities. Right. In Chico, California, which is just a 20-minute drive from Paradise, you saw their population spike 20,000 just in a period of a few years after the fire. And today you have conflict from those that live and have called Chico home, voters who are coming out against affordable housing. So we're starting to see, and I've seen that firsthand in Chico and in Paradise, this conflict that emerges when people are on the move. And this is very similar to what happened back in 2006 following Hurricane Katrina, when you had more than a million migrants, climate migrants, that were dispersed across the country and weren't always welcomed by their host communities. Georgetown University finding that some communities became less supportive of funding for programs for the poor and for African Americans. And I believe that this is a critical fault line for our nation and other countries to pay attention to, because while moving is in some cases the best option, it does prevent a host of other conflicts for both communities that are host communities and those people who have lost their communities and are looking to start over again.
Well, the name of the book is Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. The author is Jonathan Vigliotti. Real quick, Jonathan, website people can go to learn more about your work and this book?
Yeah. I'm on Instagram at Jonathan Vigliotti, and I do have a website that's not as updated, jonathanvigliotti.com.
All right, perfect. And let's have you back, because obviously this story is just beginning.
I would love to.
Ongoing. We'll stay in touch. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.